Good evening, everyone, at the Reading Odyssey Group. We're May 16th, 2017. We are gathered tonight to discuss the third play in the Oresteia trilogy called The Eumenides. And I think if you missed my bad joke last time, you'll have to go back to the podcast and listen to it. Okay, it's at the end. We are very happy to have Phil Terry with us and Sarah Rudin, who is the translator of these and some other plays, and the edition, the Greek plays, translations edited by Mary Lefkowitz and James Rom. So, all right. We had a little bit of correspondence in the past few weeks on email, so we can bring up some of those questions. Articles that have been coming across talking about Greek tragedy and how Greek tragedy relates to current events. But the first thing we like to do is to open up the forum for favorite quotes, any questions that are burning to be asked. So I'm going to open up the floor here. So if you have a question or a comment, just go ahead and announce your first name for us before you speak, and then we can get to know your voice.
Yeah, and let's definitely start with favorite passages.
Yeah.
At least to begin. And what, Andre, why don't you call on someone?
Okay.
Give a cold call.
Well, Alan, do you have anything that stood out to you in the last couple weeks? Something from the Eumenides?
Well, let me just give you my favorite passage, and then we can go from there.
Sure.
My favorite passage out of this whole thing is the screed that Apollo starts out with on about line 180. Where he's really yelling at the Furies. And the imagery and the vehemence of his speech is just, I mean, it just sent chills down my spine.
Can you read a little bit of it for us?
Yeah, read a little for us.
Yeah. Let me just start with about 184. It says, he's yelling at the Furies. It's a disgrace that you come near my temple. And then here we don't have beheadings, gouged out eyes from guilty verdicts, massacres, uprooting of manhood as it sprouts in boys, hacked limbs, stoning, and pitiful loud moans from those impaled beneath their spines. Can't you believe how much the gods abhor the celebrations you're so attached to? As your bodies show in every feature, you should share a cave with a blood-guzzling lion and not wipe your dirt on the other on others at this oracle. You strays, you feral goats, move off. No god has any fondness for a herd like yours.
wow. Yeah.
You kind of want to say, well, Paulo, you know, why are you hiding your words here? Like, one, two,
three. That's great. Tell us really big.
Yeah, I know. That was sort of like, do you have an opinion about this, Apollo? And but I guess this is a way of outlining what vengeance and the Furies representing, I guess, irrational justice, what happens when that is brought to the fore.
It's such a powerful such a powerful passage that you say, like you said, it symbolizes one of those tensions running through this whole play. It's actually one of the most, if not the most important tension. I don't know, but it's a great way to start this. Anybody else? Anybody else have any comments on that, or did you notice anything in those lines that strike you? It's very graphic. Really gives you a sense of what punishment had been like and was like up to that point, and justice, right? And now we're questioning it at some point here. All right.
Apollo seems a little arrogant, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has that characteristic in other tellings as well. So I never knew why, but he has that, right? Kind of condescending.
Yeah, this is Brian.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me, I think he's arrogant because he's kind of like the modern voice. We're not going to be like the old people anymore and take vengeance the way we used to. Now we have a new way.
Yeah.
And that new way is better than the old way. So it's kind of like the modern voice is saying the old societal ways are gone and they're ridiculous and savage. And here's the new and better way of doing things when we have a situation like this.
So old versus new, right? We have Apollo, I guess, as part of the new generation of gods. Are the Furies part of the older generation of gods or goddesses?
I think they're old.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think the Furies and Aphrodite have basically a parallel origin. When Cronus castrated his father, threw his genitals into the ocean, and from them the Furies emerged, and from the foam on the ocean, Aphrodite emerged.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting, the sort of parallel genesis, as it were, of the two.
Yeah.
This is Sean. Could we also argue that Apollo is just going on the attack because he knows he's freaking guilty? Right?
Well,
I mean, he did this.
Yeah, he did. He did encourage Orestes to do this, right? Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Alan. He did more than encourage. He directed Orestes to do this. And Apollo doesn't come up with, I don't think he's coming up with an alternative form of justice. He's just saying, the Furies, you're bad and you're wrong. It's Athena, it becomes in as the calm negotiator, moderator between the Furies and Apollo. That's the way I read the thing.
Okay.
Did not Apollo initially guarantee to Orestes that he would be unmolested by the consequences of the act?
I believe so.
In other words, do this because I'm directing you to, and I'll cover you.
Yeah. I believe that was Apollo's promise.
This is Stephen. He has a reason for what he says, and a relatively good reason, because if you look at line 210 or thereabouts, asking, the Furies are saying, we are doing right and justice. And Apollo says, what is this high office? What is this great distinction? And the chorus, we drive from home whoever kills his mother. And if a wife disposes of her husband, she doesn't raise her hand to draw shared blood. And then Apollo says, then you degrade, annihilate the bonds of Hera the fulfiller and of Zeus. What you urge throws the Cyprian, which I think is a reference to Venus, who brings the dearest mortal gifts into the dirt. A husband and wife sped their destiny, so forth and so on. But he's saying, how does one sort of killing get justified over another?
Yes. This is great.
And he offers an equally absurd rationale on his own side, saying that basically there's no blood relation between the mother and the son.
Oh, yeah, that does come out. But before we get to that, though, this is really interesting. So we could say we have a conflict between one type of justice and another. Maybe. Some of you may not like that. But let me just throw that out there as one possible, right? We have a conflict between old and new generations. You know, Apollo is one of the newer generation, sees things one way. We got the Furies and the old. Now we have a conflict between what is considered to be blood relationships and something else, right? And however Apollo spins it, he is arguing or advocating for some sort of relationship that exists between two people who are married, even though it's not blood relation, right? So that's interesting. All right. I'm just trying to keep track of all this.
I have a question. I'm sure that we have
crime.
Okay, go ahead.
Say that again.
I'm sorry, this is Ed. I was going to say that it almost seems as though Apollo is looking beyond the blood crime, because around line 220 he says, "You look away from anger and revenge. I'll tell you, you've wronged Orestes, whom you made an outcast." In other words, you should not have made Orestes an outcast, because he had anger and sought revenge.
Interesting. So what is that?
In other words, well, I think Apollo is calling into question the entire basis of the quote-unquote old gods' ethos and raison d'etre. And I think that's carried out through the resolution of the play, where essentially they're bought off by being given a new raison d'etre.
Which is
they're transitioning to going from the Furies to the kindly ones. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You talk about the transition. That's pretty severe.
Yeah. Yeah. A real about face.
I mean, I know I've made a huge leap there, but oh well.
No, that's fine. That's good. And we're gonna get there. But this is really interesting. Apollo's argument is a little harder for me to follow than the the chorus, or as we know, the Furies. And why is that? Yeah.
Another, I think, interesting point here, and I could be wrong about this, but another, I think, juxtaposition you can see is Apollo in the pantheon of new gods representing order. We always talk about the Apollonian, and the chorus representing the deepest, darkest chaos from the early gods, from, depending on which origin story you take, they represent chaos and darkest desire. They're even beneath Dionysian in terms of their sort of primordial urge to one thing.
Yeah. So would you, Stephen, would you define that maybe as emotional or instinctual, or I mean, I don't know. I'm just.
It's sort of old law, eye for an eye.
Okay.
Beyond eye for an eye, lex talionis, and the new law, maybe we should consider why some of these things were done rather than just immediately react.
Okay.
Hi, this is Stuart.
I think
they represent a sort of pre-civilized city idea of justice, which is totally based on clan and family. And the conflict is, well, what is justice when it's no longer based solely on, this is our tribe, but rather, there are killing a husband is equal to killing your mother. I mean, it's sort of I sort of see it as, and again, the introduction of the jury system. I see it as an attempt to sort of say that there can be a more, especially in a society, there can be a more reasonable approach to justice than it's simply being based on blood, which is what the Furies keep emphasizing. There's the primary reason for retribution is because he killed his mother, and he's part of her blood. I mean, it's not a form of justice that that we sort of identify with. As being part of, social construction.
Yeah, well, you're right.
I think you're very right in that there's a transition to a law and order ethos. But the Furies, I mean, number one, their name, just the name itself, Fury, and the fact that there's three of them that are actually sisters and have different roles in accomplishing the task, if you will, of the Furies. Distinguish between types of crimes. So they're talking about crimes of blood, but familial blood. Had Orestes simply killed someone for whom he had no blood relation, the Furies would not have been involved whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, this is Nick, just to play the devil's advocate a little bit. This is Nick, sorry.
I mean, yeah. I kind of, in a way, agree with the theory's position. You know, to kill your blood relation is a horrible crime. And if they allow this to go unpunished, then people will just start killing each other left and right. You know, if your mother spanks you because you stole a cookie, oh, you just kill her, and who cares, right? There's no law and order. So in a way, they're actually, you know, making sure that law and order does exist, right?
Yeah. They're drawing a line under it, saying this is a particularly horrible crime, and therefore there is a particularly horrible penalty.
Yeah.
Right.
Let me jump in, guys. This is a good discussion. This is Phil. And I want to just encourage a few more voices to get in here. Patricia, I'm glad you're with us tonight. I wonder if you could share with us a passage that you particularly liked, or if you wanted to respond to the conversation we're having right now, either way. You with us?
Actually, I had hoped to just listen today because it's my first time.
Okay.
I'll bring something up that I can't really talk in depth about because I read the play only once. But what it... And so I noticed a few things. One was that break in the unity of time and place, which is very long ago studies of theater history, is very unusual for that period. And how it really illustrates that change in order from the ancient order to the newer democratic order in Athens. And then the other thing is that I've just started thinking about, and I can't quite articulate it, but I think there is some element in there in breaking with an older matriarchal order to institute, and it's portrayed in a very negative way, because there is this establishment of the new order, which is also more patriarchal. So one kernel I saw there was this discussion of the bloodline and the strange interpretation of the mother as a vessel, a pure vessel. That argument that is, and I don't have the line, I'm sorry, I wasn't really that familiar.
Yeah, it's during the trial with Athena, and Athena essentially.
Yeah, exactly. In the trial there is this legalistic sounding point, but it's also a break with how a matriarchy was defined, where basically the only sure link was between the mother and her offspring, her children. So those are my thoughts, and I don't know whether they fit. But that's what I've been trying to dig into a little bit. I didn't get far enough.
That's excellent. Can we add that, like, do you see it as like a matriarchal, patriarchal kind of tension in this play?
I think, yeah, that the Furies represent, you know, the matriarchal order in some way, and they're portrayed in a really negative way because that's the old that is to be replaced by the new. So it's natural that it's portrayed negatively. And so actually one passage that also struck me is basically the lament towards the end, the chorus that is repeated so many times that represents us in a way. That's line 8. I found it now, 8:30 something. For me to endure this, for me with my ancient wisdom to live beneath this land, disgraced, defiled. Absolute is my rage, my fury. What is this agony creeping into my body? O Mother Night, the gods who win every match have wrenched me away from my venerable post. I am nothing now. Yeah. That's somehow one passage I marked. And it's repeated several times in this negotiation for a new role for them.
Right.
That's great.
Bill. I think you're totally right about the patriarchy, or you could look at it as sort of the replacement of the family as the core sort of engine of justice to a political system.
Now,
is a source of justice. Because what's interesting about the end and of course it's a woman, Athena, who convinces the Furies to go along with this, which I think is interesting. But mm-hmm. but in the end, you know, what convinces the Furies to give up their anger is sort of this combination, I think, of a threat from Athena, but also she appeals to them that this is really the way that families will prosper, that if the Furies will take up a different role, it will actually be to the benefit of families. Because I think, you know, they're very much, you know, and that shows how concerned they were with sort of the integrity and the well-being of family, as opposed to the political order, which is, you know, seems to be what has triumphed in terms of the outcome of the play.
Mm. Yeah, it is a rather stunning turn, though, at the end. Pretty sad. So.
Well, it's an example of incredible negotiation.
Right.
I mean, obviously it's fixed, but nonetheless, if you take it, you know, just on its own terms, Athena does a pretty incredible job. And it's not totally arbitrary. I mean, she does make an argument, and I think it's largely this argument around the family, that if you take this other role, you'll be able to help families even more than this sort of endless quest for this judgment that ends up, you know, causing a lot of ruin, even if it does achieve justice. But anyways.
Yes, and she offers them a prestigious new role.
Exactly. Brilliant negotiation. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Totally brilliant. And but by the way, she knows where Zeus keeps the lightning bolts.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Don't forget that.
She shouldn't have to mention that, as she says. But I'll tell you anyway. Yep. I got the key.
And we're discussing this as a battle between two god systems. But what do people think Orestes should have done? I mean, in other words, should he have done nothing? I mean, his father was murdered. I mean, you know, to step aside for a second from the idea of two systems of God that are, you know, in contention with each other. What about the action that he took? Should he, in other words, if we sympathize with the Furies, are we saying, as a system, are we saying Orestes should have done nothing? That his sense of injustice was not worth even considering? I mean, I have that question.
No, I don't think you're saying. I don't think one's saying that at all, or not necessarily, because Orestes wasn't in a particularly difficult position. He had a difficult task to accomplish, which would result in his damnation. I think that he had to go into it with his eyes wide open. The fact that Apollo was willing to give him cover, if you will, as I've said before, was icing on the cake. But he knew what he had to do in that society. He also knew that having done what he had to do, the Furies would come after him.
Mm.
That was the system.
So the interesting question is, would he have done it if Apollo hadn't given him assurances? Would he have killed his mother anyways?
Unknown. It's an interesting question, because that then goes to his determination, his bravery, if you will, in a sense.
I think he would have killed Aegisthus without any question, but I think it's interesting that you ask that question, and I say, you know, or you ask the question about was he right to have killed his mother under Apollo's order, as it were, and I would, and someone said, well, his mother killed his father, but his father killed his sister.
I think Agamemnon's a bum. I agree with you. I think Agamemnon was a bum, and I don't know that the mother should have died in this situation, but maybe I'm too modern in my thinking.
Where were the Furies to Agamemnon? Is he subject to their punishment as well? It seems like he should have been a blood killer.
But I want to just push Josh Kirshner. Josh, what do you think as we're discussing this? And did you have a favorite passage?
Well, I'm sorry. That was me just commenting on the Agamemnon thing.
Oh, that was you? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. My favorite passage, I think we've already talked about it. I mean, one of my favorite passages was when Athena makes that transition to soothe the Furies at the end. Which it was, you know, what struck me about this book, though, versus this play versus some of the other plays we've read, is this one seemed to be much more overtly political than the last one. And
I agree, curious, but what do you mean by how? In what ways do you see it as overtly political?
In terms of reflecting the evolving class structures within Athens, the evolving democracy, and the different classes.
Even making direct reference to the potential coming civil war with Sparta.
Not the Sparta, no, but within Athens itself. So there was a mention of the Sparta, but also, no, in terms of the setting up of the jury system, and I, you know, Sarah, I think you talk about this in the introduction to the play about how you have sort of the competing aristocracy of Athens that is being somewhat displaced by a more broader democracy of the people, and how that in some ways reflected in how the jury structure is taking place here.
Yeah.
This is Alan. I couldn't agree with you more. At the end, I'm left with the feeling that he writes this as an homage to how wonderful and what a great solution to developing justice to have the jury system, and that we all ought to just be very happy that we have this as a way to bring justice even-handedly, rationally, instead of having people go off and do blood feud killings. And so I think this is almost his homage to how wonderful Athens is in moving civilization forward to its next step by the jury system.
I would say, though, this is Sarah. Yeah, I would just put in a word of caution.
Hey, Sarah.
There. Yes, hi.
Go ahead. Let's have you join us now. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it would be wrong to read in, you know, any close similarity to the modern justice system when we talk about, say, jury, the jury system or the rule of law. We're talking about, you know, justice applied as an abstract principle, whereas, you know, what you actually see going on in the play is, you know, very similar to, you know, what the Athenian legal system was like, and it was more like a system of negotiations. You know, we have people who are at odds with each other, so what do we give each party so that this can be settled without violence? You know, and how do we do this in a way that it will, you know, generate good for the community. So all of these practical considerations, I think, played a much greater role than they do today in a courtroom. So we would be asking, you know, what are the facts here, and how does the law apply to them on an equal basis? And, you know, and there are a lot of abstractions involved, and we're not so very concerned about, you know, what the outcome will be of punishing one person or rewarding another person.
Cool. What do you think, Sarah, about this conversation that we've been having in general? How's it going for you listening to our conversation and discussion? What for you... you know, what's most compelling for you about this play?
I am but a simple translator, so I react mainly, you know, emotionally to these texts, and I am just really struck here with the, if you will, the poetry of violence And I'm a Quaker myself, so we are strict Baptists. So I'm always in a strange place when I translate most ancient literature, because it just has a reflects a very different value system and a more, if you will, primordial feeling about human conflict than we are, you know, used to, certainly in our everyday life.
Fellow reader Ellen Davis who started us off with a favorite passage, lines 180, where Apollo is talking to the Furies, trying to kick them out. And I suppose that's a great example of your poetry of violence. Would that be fair?
Yeah, you know, I once got asked at a lecture, and I was speaking about a Aeneid translation, and I was asked about the so-called, you know,
by the way.
Oh, thank you. But the aesthetics of, yeah, the aesthetics of violence. And I said, well, the only thing that I could think of, you know, to reply was to defend the poet was to point to nature documentaries. life on the Serengeti. So it's a documentary will show the cubs playing, you know, it'll show the lions at the watering hole, and then it will show the lions bringing down a wildebeest and gorging themselves on it. And it's all kind of, you know, it's all about the beauty of the natural world and the beauty of and the beauty of the social world too, as they saw it. You know, everything that they looked at was just imbued with divine power. So they didn't, you know, they weren't catchy in thinking about violence. You know, violence is part of the natural order.
Yeah. What did the Greeks think? What did the contemporaries of Aeschylus think, his audience, of the Furies? Were the Furies just one part of the universe of gods, separate from the Olympian gods? And, you know, did they reject them in some sense, see them as from an older time? And what was,
yeah,
you know...
I don't think that they had, you know, the binary attitude that's characteristic of, you know, Judeo-Christian society and, you know, of all three religions of the book. I do not think they had that attitude at all, that you could simply reject the Furies. And you know, that plays out, you know, very cogently in the book. They can't just drive these goddesses out of the land because they are goddesses. They are powerful, so they have to make a place for them. They have to accommodate them in their polity and in their rituals, and they have to concede quite a bit of power to these divine creatures. I think there's a story. Yes, that the sight of this chorus was so horrifying that, you know, it caused extreme reactions in the audiences.
That's interesting.
There is that, you know, the sight actually of the chorus of the actors was supposed to have been really horrifying.
Yeah. So I heard a question coming up. Yeah, go ahead.
And I wanted to note both on the comment about the poetics of violence and the idea of, well, one of the things that occurs to me is one of the origin stories of the Furies is that they are the daughters of night. And their chief rival is Day, Apollo. And ultimately, they are incorporated into Day. It's, if you want to be really Jungian about it,
It is basically that dark, chaotic thing exists and will continue to exist. As Sarah said, they're powerful goddesses. They have to be. They have to be palliated. They have to be, appropriately repurposed. But they are still who they are, even if they, claim a new role in what's happening. And that, I think, is an interesting point. Well, maybe a contrived point that I'm making up, but looking at it, Aeschylus seems to say to us that there is at the heart of the law and the heart of justice this thirst for vengeance, and rightfully so, because it's one of those things that helps us define what's right and wrong, but it has to be harnessed, chained, and properly used. So night becomes part of day.
Interesting. I like it. It's poetic, and it's a poetic understanding of this. Sarah, did you want to respond to that at all?
Oh no, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, Andre, what were you thinking about as we read this play and as the conversation was going this evening? And was there anything in particular you wanted to ask,
Sarah? Well, going back to I think what Patricia was talking about, this tension between matriarchy, patriarchy, I started seeing it more in the last play with Clytemnestra and her role in trying to keep her family together, and yet on the other hand. She made the decision to kill her husband, but there had to be a reason for this. There had to be a good reason in her mind for it. And now her son's coming back, and he has a good reason to do away with her. And it's just, it's tearing the family apart. So and how does democracy relate to the fact that a woman is nominally in charge, after the king Agamemnon had been killed? I don't know. I don't really know what to make of it. It was a question that came up, and I wasn't sure if that was deliberately, proposed. Like, could women have more of a leading role, or is it just not going to work out? Is it just not possible? Because Athens at the time was pretty, patriarchal, and I guess only men had citizenship, but in a democracy, you might have more opportunities for others to play a role in the society. So I don't know if that tension's in there, if other people saw that or not.
Well, I think that the tension definitely is in there. That it might have to do, with the particular moment in period of Athenian history that we're talking about. So we're almost in the middle of the 5th century here, and the democracy is solidifying, and it wasn't the case that women were not citizens, but the democracy was emphatically male. And it had to do a lot with, women retreating indoors and, losing, whatever public visibility they had. They had no, political role per se, but they were sort of put aside, put in a sheltered place, much like the Furies themselves are when they become the Amenities. They are put in a honored, comfortable place, but it's a place they can't get out of.
Yeah.
And this had to do with the dividing up the spoils of democracy. So Athens is forming an empire, and citizenship is an increasingly good deal, so the Athenians want to make it exclusive, and so they say that the only person who can be a citizen is the child of a male and a female citizen. So the big question then became, you know, who was the legitimate? It had to be the legitimate child. So the hunt for illegitimacy, you know, became a means of disenfranchising people, or a potential way to narrow down the number of people who are going to share in this, you know, lucrative privilege of a citizenship. So ironically, the development of this great democracy, in many practical ways, put women aside, you know, segregated and oppressed women. They were citizens, and, you know, they were sharing the goodies, but in a less and less public way.
Yeah, this is Nick. I just want to comment on that. I totally agree with your points, and they're very good. I was struck, though, as you were speaking, that it's interesting that the patron god of Athens, though, is a woman, after all, right? And mm-hmm. what is so interesting in this play, well, Athena, right, is a woman, and mm-hmm. she is the one, sorry?
Yes.
And she is the one who basically is instituting this, I guess, this jury system, which has these really profound and amazing consequences for Western civilization. I was talking to my wife, who's Chinese, and I said, do they have juries in China? And she said, no. And I just found that so amazing and so profound that I'm reading this play where, I guess, according to their legend, that this is how this started, the jury system. And they're giving credit to this to a female goddess, really. So I agree with what you say about how the males had this dominant role in society, but it's interesting that were women perceived to be more negotiators or you know, soliciting other people's views in order to come to consensus about a verdict, whereas a male was less inclined to do that? I don't know. I just found this all very interesting as I was listening to your comments.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating, the role of female deities and the contrast, you know, and the status of real women. And I wouldn't say that women were considered negotiators. In fact, a sort of opposite dichotomy prevailed to ours. You know, we tend to think this is just our pop culture, and our assumptions, often unspoken, but we tend to think that, you know, men are the creatures of nature, because men are more violent, you know, men are more motivated by sex. You know, this is just the stuff that we say and our common assumptions. And I'm not saying, you know what reality is behind this, but this is just, these are assumptions on which our society is built. Greek society was the opposite, very much the opposite. Women were, irrational, violent, destructive, driven by sex. The creatures of civilization. They were the people who could reason, who could argue, who could work things out peaceably, and this is why. And they would tell you, you know, this is why men are the proper warriors. You know, unlike the Amazons, you know, men are the people who should wage war, because, you know, they will do it for justice, you know, for God and country, and they'll do it for the community. Whereas women, when they are violent, are like Clytemnestra. You know, they will strike out of personal anger.
Right.
Legends about the Amazon, you know, are the same.
What other questions or comments do we have for Sarah or just in general? Sean, we heard your voice earlier in the call. Haven't heard from you in a little while. I think you might have been in there.
No, I'm good for now.
Okay.
I have a question, Stuart. Where does the Dionysian cult fit in this system? I mean, what is that just for other stories, or is that a separate, you know, cult system, or how does it relate to the Furies as a practice area, religious practice area?
Sarah, did you hear that?
Sorry. I thought that was directed. Was that directed at me?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, any of us can comment, but I think in particular, yeah. He was asking about Dionysus and the cult of Dionysus, and how did that connect to, or does it relate to the Furies at all, or no?
That's a real toughie. You know, I could, if I knew more, I could go into Nietzsche and talk about, you know, the Dionysian mode and the Apollonian mode. There's a, you know, he developed this theory about the opposition between Apollonian and Dionysian, you know, being very important in this development of tragedy. I wouldn't really know. First, I'm not sure that I buy that, and then I wouldn't know how the Furies would fit into that. So that's sort of way above my pay grade. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no, I don't know. Go ahead.
So Stephen, I'm not sure about Dionysian, but I did have sort of, I'm not sure it's a question, more an observation, and that is, it's interesting that this capstone of a tragic trilogy is actually, in modern terms at least, a comedy. Orestes gets away, the Furies are converted into the kindly ones, and there's something that at least resembles a happy ending. And I think that's an interesting aspect of, interesting and for me a little bit disconcerting aspect of this sort of tragic trilogy.
So that's an important point. And before Sarah, you responded, I'd love to hear from others, of other readers. Do you agree with that? Someone was about to jump in.
Yeah, this is Ed again. I was about to jump in saying, I don't see it as a comedy at all. I think it's truly a tragedy because Orestes is placed in truly tragic circumstances through no fault of his own. His simple existence is a tragedy. And that individual tragedy seems to permutate into a societal tragedy with his transition from the old to the new gods and old and new way of looking at things. And if you look at Apollo's actual arguments, they're specious. Well, by our definitions or our understandings, of course. I mean, his, you know, the notion of the female of the species of the woman as a simple receptacle and having nothing to do with the birth of the child, so on and so forth, is just, you know, it's just pure spin. Ultimately, the, if you will, citizen or human jury is a hung jury, and the deciding vote is cast by a goddess. So how is this anything other than a tragedy?
Orestes lives. He goes off to live a fruitful, long life.
I
think Athens, it was a tie vote, wasn't it? And so Athena cast a tie vote, which made it the acquittal. He would have been convicted, I think.
But the point is, he wasn't convicted. My whole point.
No, I know, I understand that, but it was.
You can't throw it into it. The circumstances that begin it are tragic. It's kind of like Antonio in The Merchant of Venice. yes, he owes a pound of flesh to Shylock the Jew, but Shylock doesn't get to collect. That turns The Merchant of Venice into a potential tragedy, a tragedy for most of the play, and it becomes a comedy because the hero gets off.
And in this case, doesn't this go from a personal tragedy to a societal tragedy? In other words, it transfers, Apollo uses this as the new god and the new wave, if you will, to transition from the old way to the new way via the personal
right.
tragedy of this individual that who is ultimately held blameless. He gets to reclaim his kingdom and, as you said, live a happy, well, presumably a happy life. Although, who knows? But while his individual sin is exculpated, the societal implications are huge because now you have a divided society that have to decide.
But now you have trial.
A new framework has been created.
You now have trial by jury rather than justice of blood.
Sure.
Well, I would argue that that's not a societal tragedy. That's actually, I mean, there's lots of ways to look at it. But I look at it and say, let me see. Would I rather have the way the Furies decide things or the way the trial decided things, even if the individual verdict was unjust?
But looking at it from the point of view of the individuals at the time, has not their lives become vastly more complicated?
Complicated isn't necessarily tragic.
Perhaps not.
Is part of this discussion maybe wrapped around what's the definition that a second lease would use for tragedy? Is our definition of tragedy the same as a Greek of that time would call a tragedy?
Sarah, would you weigh in here? How did the ancient Greeks see this as a tragedy, the way this ended?
I think they would have seen the tragedy tragedy is the genre that is put on under the label tragedy. It's the thing that occurs at the time and the place for tragedy and not for comedy. And so there was no rule against. Maybe it would help to think about another tragedy that has a happy ending, which is the Alcestis. That's a Euripides tragedy. It's later, and it's supposed to, in fact, be related to the Little Comedy. But anyway, it's certainly in the tragic category for the Athenians. And in this play, a wife gives her life for her husband. So he is supposed to be the one dying, going to Hades, and she sacrifices herself so that he can live, and then she is retrieved from Hades, by divine intervention, and everybody's happy. The couple is reunited. Joy is unconfined, and so you have what we would call a comic ending, an ending reunion, reconciliation. In some ways like the ending of the Eumenides. So that seems to be the crutch for us anyway as moderns thinking about tragedy. What is tragic about those stories? What's different from a comedy, ancient one, or a modern one? Why is this in a very different category?
So Sarah, what I hear you saying, and I'm going to say something a little bit different. What I hear you saying is that, in a very real sense, these were the serious plays as opposed to the satyr plays that came in between them. So that we call them tragedy, they were called tragedies at the time, but they were, and I guess, I don't even know if they had anything we would call comedy until Aristophanes. I don't know enough about Greek drama to know. But if we substitute for this the word serious plays, the high drama, as it were, as opposed to the Seder plays, that's really what they mean when they say tragedy, because that allows for these two examples you've noted of comic endings.
Mm-hmm. If we wanted to be, I guess, really fundamental in sketching the difference, you would never. There was very little. Well, I don't know. There are things. There are things in tragedy, as in, you know, Shakespearean tragedy. There are things you can laugh at. You know, there are comic characters. There are comic scenes. You know, I was going to say that at a Seder play or at a comedy, you would laugh uproariously. Again, I could point to just practical outward genre differences. In the comedy, you've got actors wearing giant phalluses. Not so in tragedy, you know. And of course, the Seder plays, you know, have Seder costumes, and that's characteristic of that genre. So I think it might be useful, maybe not satisfying, but might be accurate to look at formal aspects, which are, you know, in my thinking, more dominant in ancient literature. You know, this was a literature with, you know, very strict rules for meter to be used in different genres and to be used in different places, in a say tragedy or a comedy. They weren't maybe thinking so generally about the differences, but we're thinking more about what something looked like, what something sounded like, you know, these physical differences between different kinds of literature.
Hi, let me jump in. This is great. I want to shift gears because we don't have that much more time left, and I want to get a few more questions in. So I had a very tactical question for you, Sarah. Around line 860, we have Athena talking to the Furies, and she says basically, "Don't plant a civil war among my townsmen that turns their courage back against each other. Let there be foreign wars, though plenty of them, for anyone who grimly lusts for glory, but not a rooster feuding in his yard." The footnote then suggests that this was a moment that Athenian militarism was at its peak, and the empire was growing and at its largest extent, and conflict with Sparta was beginning. So when Athena says, "Don't plan a civil war among my townsmen," is she referring to Sparta and Athens in that sense? Or is it within Athens that she's referring to?
Yeah, well, the conflict between Sparta and Athens, I don't think would have been considered a civil war. There had been, you know, over the generations, you know, lots and lots of civil conflict within Athens. So that would, I think, that would explain this line better, I think.
And the foreign wars would be the wars to expand the empire and take more parts of the Persian Empire and the Aegean and so forth. Is that the foreign wars, or would the foreign wars include potentially wars with other Greek cities like Sparta? Or do you know?
We've got a pretty early date here. We're in 458, so I don't really think. But I don't know. You know, I'm not a historian. You'd have to ask a historian.
Yeah.
But I don't really think that war with Sparta would have been on Aeschylus's mind yet, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. The war began in 430, was it? 431, 430, I forget. Right around there. So, you know, what, 25 years after this was written or so, 20 years? Yeah. Okay. All right. Other questions for Sarah, or just, again, general comments about the play? Did anyone feel like they either really liked this play or it didn't really sort of capture them, either side of that?
This is Nan.
I really liked it.
Yeah. I heard two voices there, I think. The first voice, I didn't hear what they said. The second said really liked it. Was there a first voice?
Yeah, I said, this is Nan. I actually wasn't thrilled with this one. This was one of the first readings in the Reading Odyssey that it didn't grab me, it didn't hold my attention. I was kind of bored with it.
Just left you cold?
Yeah. I think it kind of reminded me, especially in the beginning, when we first started the discussion about Apollo kind of yelling at the Furies, it reminded me of the news shows and the talk shows today where everybody's just yelling at each other. And it's just like, I don't even want to deal with it. No one's listening to each other and they're just yelling back and forth. And that's how I felt reading this. And then I did have a question too, because at the end, like, everybody's talking about the kind of the Furies just kind of give in to Athena and she almost like buys them off. It seemed to me like she just buys them off. Because line, I think it's 899.
Yeah.
I felt like Athena was pulling a fast one, because she says, I'm free to make no promise I won't keep. And I kept reading that, like, what is she really saying? If I take away the, like, it's a double negative, so it's like, I'm free to make promises I'll keep, but it didn't sound like that's what she was saying. It's almost like she's not promising to keep her secrets. She's not promising to keep the promises she makes, is how I read that, even though it's probably not the way it's said, but just the way it's phrased and the way it's said. I just thought, is she pulling a fast one on the Furies? Is she kind of giving them a little razzle-dazzle salesmanship? And what is she really saying there?
I've got the Greek right here.
Accepted.
Yeah. It is permitted. It is possible to me. It's possible to me not to say those things which I do not bring to fulfillment. It is a double negative. Yeah,
yeah.
Two negative.
I guess what confused me about this line was, I get the double negative, but the part where she says, but she begins it by saying, I'm free. So I did the same thing Nan did. So I said, I'm free to make a promise I'll keep. Make a promise I'll keep makes sense to me. I didn't get the free part. So I kind of went around.
Uh-huh. It's Exeston. This is her proper role. This is her. She's not the head god. She's a subordinate god, so a very powerful one. And it is permitted to her. It is allowed to her. Not to say that which she won't. She's a free agent. I think that's the closest. I mean, with Aeschylus, you kind of never know. some of these, you don't want to nail things down too hard when you translate, and you feel horrible if you kind of leave people floating. Confused and frustrated with the text, but you don't want to nail things down too hard, because we do have some evidence that it wasn't all crystal clear, to his contemporaries. He was a hard poet, even in the eyes of his contemporaries. So Yeah, it seems to me, you know, as well as I can read it, it seems to me that she says, you know, I have, I am a empowered agent here. You know, I can work.
It's almost like
out.
She's saying, I'm not just giving you lip service. I'm not going to say things I'm not going to do. Whatever I say, I will fulfill. Is basically what she's saying. It's
yeah,
like I'm not.
Yeah. But she's saying that. She's not saying just. She's saying that that is her place in the order of things.
Yeah.
That when in this circumstance she can give her word and keep it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So who was the second person that said that they really liked it, the play? Can we go back to that?
I had said that I really liked it, Ed.
Yeah. And Ed, what for you did you really like about it?
Well, I liked the whole transitional nature of what I saw going on. Just to step back to a second to what Sarah was saying, you know, is there any possibility that Aeschylus, as the playwright writing a play for a competition, didn't necessarily embed a device that would leave people talking about what they had just experienced, going home a little confused, or perhaps unclear, and thereby taking sides in the discussion?
I don't know. I think that I think that's a very very much possible. Think of tragedy as sport. it's not a very wild analogy. You know, this was very central to public life. This is something they were just tremendously proud of, something, you know, in which they participated very, very eagerly. So the ideas in the plays, I think, were very lively ones for them. You know, things in which none of these ideas were pat or dull for them, which, you know, contributes to, you know, some confusion and a lot of interest for us in reading these so many centuries later.
Yeah, it seems that the plays were chosen and put on. So to that extent, they must have had, someone must have seen some educational, if you will, or steering capacity in them. In other words, the questions that they raised were questions that presumably the people who made those decisions at that time thought needed to be discussed or brought to the fore. They weren't simply entertainment.
Yeah, well, and you can also think about certain controversies around plays. You could be, if you put on the wrong play and upset people, you could be prosecuted.
Sure. But Aeschylus didn't put the play on.
A very,
of his own
belief. You could create a lot of political controversy and get yourself into trouble, you know, by saying what people just didn't want to hear. It was considered unhelpful.
Fortunately, we don't have that rule today. Or unfortunately, if some might think. That's funny. Scott Thompson, what about you? What did this play mean to you? Did you like it, not like it? Did it resonate?
I loved it. I mean, I couldn't get away from the fact that I guess all three of these plays were seen in a single day, right? It's incredibly ambitious what Aeschylus is doing. He's taking an ancient revenge story, one of the great Greek revenge stories that everybody knew, and fashioning it into this sort of myth origin story about transitioning from Homer's world to something that to a kind of world that we can almost sort of some aspects of recognize. So I think it was hugely ambitious. I'm sure it didn't succeed completely, but I thought it was a great thing to try and worked really well. When Patricia and Bill were talking earlier about the matriarchal replacement by patriarchy at the same time as a more formal system of justice, but also the idea that you're reconciling these opposites. I think Stephen was talking about that too. There's a really good point around line 520 when the Furies talk about the necessity of terror as a part of justice. There is a fitting place for terror. The overseer of the mind must sit there constantly. And then, like 200 lines later, Athena is addressing...
Wait, hold on a second. I just want to give everyone a chance to see. So around 520? Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, it starts just before 520.
There's a fitting place for terror?
The overseer of the mind must sit there constantly. And then, like 200 lines later, just before 700, Athena is addressing the citizens, and she says, "And leave some fear, don't banish all of it. What man on earth can be both just and fearless? So if the thought of justice terrifies you, you'll have salvation for your land and city." So that's part of that reconciliation function that she has, bringing the terror of the Furies and trying to make it subordinate to the rule of law.
Well, these are lines about, they address, basic principles of tragedy. They're sort of a sidelong glance at hubris. Hubris is the lack of, the unintelligent lack of fear. Such as we're seeing in the White House right now, if I may remark. If a person is not fearless or not fearful when he ought to be, if the person doesn't have natural modesty and caution and shame, then all kinds of trouble is brewing. And that's inherent in great many tragic plots. People just get out of control.
Right. Thank you, Scott. That was helpful to hear your perspective, and you too, Sarah. Is there anyone else that has something that will help all of us see something here? Anyone else want to jump in with thoughts about what you liked or didn't like? Anyone else we haven't heard from tonight? I always want to hear everybody on the phone. Andre, would you want to wrap us up?
Okay. We had a request earlier, maybe it was before we got the recording going, about trying to place this play in context with the other two. And I think we've done that tangentially, but I was wondering if anyone had any questions or any comments about how this play kind of fits in after the other two, and how maybe people feel with the resolution, if there is one, here. We just heard a little bit about Athena and her ability to kind of, bring some closure. Maybe she does this in a sense in the Odyssey at the end, where there's a war about to start between Odysseus and some of the other people in Ithaca, and she just quells it like in a few lines. But it's sort of artificial. It's almost like a deus ex machina. Is that what's going on here at the end, or when we see this play in relation to the other two preceding it, is there a more natural kind of flow to this point? I don't know. How do people feel about that?
This is Stephen. And I thought that I thought the play was both beautiful and quite disconcerting. And I think Sarah earlier referred to the poetics of violence. I thought he could have chosen any way to run this trial that he wanted to, but he chose to let you Orestes off with an absolutely equal vote in which divinity casts sort of the deciding and freeing vote. And I find that a really interesting capstone to all of this, largely because, you know, and this is just an impression, it seems to me when I read about the Greek gods, they were more often into mischief than they were into making things right. And so here's one of those rare cases where you see them step in and they write things. And Athena's argument to the Furies, her first form of persuasion is, you weren't wrong. You know, you weren't wrong. He has gone free because of the way we've established our justice system, but you weren't wrong. And I find that a really interesting, I think that's kind of the whole story here, and a lot of our puzzling has been, well, wasn't Clytemnestra in the right because Agamemnon killed Danaea, and Atreus fed Aegisthus's father his children, and didn't Orestes waffle a little bit when it came to killing Clytemnestra? I mean, he did it because he was ordered by the oracle to do it, but I think someone brought up the question, what if he hadn't been? Would he have done it under those circumstances? And I think there's evidence in the text of the libation bearers that maybe not. And I think that's what makes this so interesting, is that it is ambiguous. The Furies were right. They can be incorporated and should be incorporated into the justice system, and that's why we have a vote as to the guilt or innocence. I don't know. I just found it satisfying.
This is good, because you're bringing up another point here. If we look past even the three plays and we go back to the curse of the House of Atreus, right? Yeah, there had to be a curse that needed to be somehow, I don't know, expiated or something. And maybe that is what's happening here, but the Furies are only looking at one crime, rather than how that crime is an expiation of a previous crime. I don't know. Is that kind of what you're thinking, or?
Yeah, I think that element is there. Is that this is a whole big? It's not easy. It's not something that you can just say, "Oh, you're bad. You killed your mother."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Apollo is the god of prophecy, of future. He can see the future. Maybe his impetus, maybe his you know, compelling Orestes to do this is maybe on a broader, you know, part of a broader expiation. I don't know. And the Furies are more focused on just the last crime that was committed. I don't know how do other people feel.
Yeah, well, I think it's this is very tough for us to think about, you know, as the people of the modern world imbued with Judeo-Christian morality, we really struggle with this. You know, and I think one idea that's come up a couple times in this discussion is what they call the tragic bind. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Orestes, you know, he had to avenge his father, yet he was, you know, subjected to terrible persecution. If he did what he was forced to do, and I don't think that kind of contradiction bothered the ancients so much. They would say, "Well, this is just a description of the world." And what's fascinating to me is the perhaps more realistic description of human life within an extremely elaborate artifice, which is a Greek play. You know, it's formally just really, really highly wrought. It doesn't seem real to us. You know, it seems like a legend, and so it should be like a fable, and so it should have a clear moral. No, it is both a very intricate work of art, and in certain ways a more realistic, a more gritty description of the world, as in, for example, you know, tough beans. You know, you are in many situations in life damned if you do and damned if you don't. This is
the
way that the universe is constructed.
That brings me to this last thing I really wanted to get in, and that was I sent out an article or a link to an article last week or so that I came across, and it had to do with the Army, you know, bringing in soldiers that have, you know, been diagnosed with PTSD and having them, you know, if they want to listen to a recitation of, you know, one of the Greek tragedies. And so how you know, based on what you're just saying and what we've discussed, how does that kind of help folks that, you know, that how does it have that beneficial kind of influence on somebody? It sounds like it might make life more complicated, you know, but in another way, it somehow is a catharsis, like, you know, like Aristotle says. I mean, any thoughts or comments on that?
Andre, are you asking how might the reading of these ancient dramas help modern soldiers with PTSD? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. And before I share a thought with you on that, it's an interesting question. I just wanted to, Scott Thompson shot me a note a few minutes ago reminding me, and boneheaded here that I can be sometimes, I completely forgot about this, but that actually there was a war referred to as the First Peloponnesian War, at least by the Athenians, that ran from 460 to 445. It was a bunch of minor conflicts between Athens and Sparta, essentially, and then it led to what was then called the 30 Years' Peace, which didn't last for 30 years, and then the major thing broke out around 430. But during the writing of this place era, Athens was in a kind of war with Sparta, it turns out.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So they were skirmishing with Sparta. They were
skirmishing through minor,
wobbles,
you know,
yeah.
tributary cities and stuff like that, but very much, you know, recognizing the Spartans were in part provoked by the building of the long walls by the Athenians. And their position was, if we don't do something about it, these guys are going to become impregnable. So we have to start fighting with the Athenians to prevent the building, the finishing of those long walls.
Okay.
All right.
I had not known whether it was tensions or actual combat that had started.
Yeah. Mainly fought through proxies, but nonetheless still seen as essentially the main guys being Athens and Sparta. Hang on just a second. Yeah.
Okay. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. All right. So I'm back. Sorry about that. So to Andre's point, yeah, what do people think about that? How would reading of these plays help modern soldiers with PTSD? What do you guys think?
Just one thing. I'm sorry I'm talking too much, but I have no idea whether it would help a soldier or not, because I've never been through that. One thing that I think was present in these plays is the Furies in some way represented a state of the murderer's mind. And I think Aeschylus had the idea that one idea of an impersonal system of justice was that it could remove some of the guilt that people who had committed a crime, justified or not, would feel. And it was a way of the system of law was supposed to, in some sense, purge people's emotions. You know, I don't know if that helps the soldiers or not, but that was something I thought was present in the play.
Yeah.
You know, I have something that you might want to take a look at. The person who is producing tragedies for military veterans as a sort of therapy is called Brian Dorfies, and I actually reviewed his work in Books and Culture, which is a magazine that is now extinct. It was part of Christianity Today and has been dropped since the end of last year. Anyway, so I might want to see if I can find an online version of this article. Might be helpful for people to look at. I didn't myself think that you know, it was a great, certainly designed as it was in this project. I didn't think that it was particularly, you know, psychologically helpful to look at to view tragedy for the remedy for PTSD.
You did or did not, Sarah? I'm sorry. Did you say you did not? Yeah.
I didn't think that the Aeschylus plays particularly did, but just for anyone who sort of followed the list, the emails that went around today, Ajax certainly addresses PTSD, and interestingly enough, Ajax in that play curses Menelaus and Agamemnon, but never mind that. And I had sent out links because there was about an hour-long interview with Dorhees, the author, translator Dorhees, in a podcast that's still available. So I'd sent that link out in a response earlier this afternoon, so I don't know if people had a chance to see that or not. It's out there.
Great.
I'd say one reason, Sarah and Andre and others, that I might think it would be helpful actually has less to do with the content of the play. Frankly, one of the key problems with PTSD is social isolation, in the sense that you're alone, and that, you know, that you're the only one feeling the way that you do. And so getting a group of soldiers together, veterans together with PTSD, to talk about these plays, or other plays for that matter, or frankly almost anything at all other than themselves, addresses the social isolation aspect to it. And it may also be that plays having to deal with war just provide a natural jumping board from which to discuss things that are maybe harder to discuss directly and personally. But I think the fact of addressing the isolation, and what I always hear from the reading odyssey, by the way, over the years from people who participate, is some version of they like the reading, they love the conversations more. You know, that the extent to which we can build some community and learn from each other in terms of how we see these texts and just experience other people enjoying these texts is has been one of the more fulfilling things for participants in the past, at least those that I've talked to about it. So I would see it that way potentially. Sorry, I'd love to read your article, but that is
Let me see if I can dig up an electronic version of it and I'll send that to Phil and he thinks it's useful, he can.
Yeah, I'll send it out to everybody. Even if it's not useful, Sarah.
Okay. It's completely useless. If it's a piece of crap, then.
Andre, what do we read?
What do you do with it?
I'm sorry. Yeah?
What's next?
Okay. We are, like I said earlier, I'm so excited. We're going to be reading some Sophocles. We're going to read two blockbusters. Okay? So get ready. It's Oedipus and Antigone. And so we're going to try a two-for-one now.
We're talking about both Oedipus and Antigone in the next call?
That's what we got on the schedule.
Oh, boy, that is so ambitious. how do we talk about those two plays in one call?
Why don't we just put it out there, and then we'll start with Oedipus, obviously, and we'll see if people want to connect the two or just want to talk about Oedipus. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and if people don't get through both, we'll still talk about one. But Why don't we just give it a try?
I don't think it's hard to get through both plays, by the way. This is not like reading a book of Herodotus each month. This is pretty quick, right? I assume most people are getting through these plays pretty fast.
Well, listen,
we can be disciplined and we'll see about cutting the conversation off and talking about Antigone.
We'll give it a try.
Okay.
So we'll start with Sophocles next time. And then our plan had been to get into Electra eventually. Well, we'll see. We'll see how things pan out next time and see if we can get into Euripides or not. But
great.
We'll definitely, yeah. So we'll
for those of you who are based in New York, the first play of Shakespeare in the Park is going to be Julius Caesar. And that begins at the end of this month. If you are interested in seeing Julius Caesar as a group, shoot me an email and let me know if you're interested in going. Again, if you're in the New York area or if you want to come into the New York area. Our next reading past these Greek plays will be the landmark Caesar, and we're going to put a whole program together with a lecture series as well as reading groups and some offline cocktail parties. So a lot being planned for that. And I thought it'd be fun if we kind of kick that off softly anyway with a group trip to see Shakespeare in the Park, Julius Caesar. So let me know if you're interested in going to that together either if you're in the area or if you would like to fly in to be a part of that. All right.
That would be great. Just as an aside, is there any word on the landmark Caesar edition?
Yeah, October 24. That's what I was saying. We have a big program that we're preparing for that. Yeah. Lecture series, reading groups, and offline cocktail parties around the country. So, very cool. All right. Well, Andre, thanks again. Sarah,
wonderful. Thanks to Sarah and Phil. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Great learning.
Thank you.
Tonight. Okay. All right. Have a good evening.
Good night. Thanks, everybody. Okay.
Good night, everyone.
All right.
Night. Out into the world.
Hello?